Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age.
Hey everyone, Peter Crosby here from the Digital Shelf Institute. The opportunity for brands to drive revenue through cross-border commerce is greater than it's ever been, but the complexity keeps rising also. The taxman cometh wherever you sell. Now, Craig Reed, Senior Vice President of Global Trade at cross-border technology provider Avalara, joined Rob and me to talk through some of the complexities and the innovations that make it possible to sell globally at the scale that's right for you. So, Craig, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We really appreciate it. We've been looking forward to talking cross-border commerce for a while.
Hey, guys. Nice to be here.
So, Craig, you've been helping brands and retailers manage that, manage the cross-border commerce challenge for more than 20 years, which seems amazing that any of us have been doing things that long, but that's how it goes. But it feels like there are massive shifts in complexity and scale that are underway right now that are different maybe than in the earlier part of your career in this. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, you sure are. As you mentioned, I've been doing this for 20 plus years. I was one of the original founders of a company called Border Free in Toronto back in 2000. And when we founded that company, it was really out of a selfish need to just get stuff from the US because nothing was really available. And, you know, we had a big challenge in that company, just getting folks to think about cross-border, getting them to be interested in cross-border business, getting them to see the opportunity relative to some of the domestic opportunities they've had. So you're right. There has been a massive shift, and it's not, you know, it's not a backwater anymore. It's not an afterthought. It's really being thought of as a huge opportunity. And certainly with COVID accelerating, that was true before COVID, but with COVID accelerating e-commerce, the tide lifts all ships, and cross-border has been no exception. So anyone who's really doing any significant amount of e-commerce is likely either thinking about doing cross-border or already doing it. And if they're not, you know, probably their competitors are. So I think it's an important thing to pay attention to for a business.
Or they're afraid of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that sort of shifts to the second part of the question, which is, what are the complexities? So, you know, when we first started out, it was relatively simple, actually. You know, there weren't that many changes going on. The tariffs were relatively stable. You know, you had NAFTA and a couple of other things, but really it was pretty straightforward, and it didn't change a lot. But now the pace of change has been dramatic. I mean, everyone's aware of Brexit, but also many people may know, but certainly I do because I'm in Canada. But Canada changed its de minimis. Other de minimis rates have changed. De minimis rates between taxes and duties have diffracted. The EU is moving to a $0 VAT rate in July. So there's all kinds of changes happening from a regulatory standpoint. And the other thing that's happening is that, governments seeing, obviously, with this huge influx and traffic of cross-border e-commerce shipments are kind of doing two things. One, they want to protect domestic businesses and level the playing field. So, you know, hey, you can't not pay duties and taxes if you're buying it from abroad. And secondly, even if you do level the playing field, you got to make sure you can collect the money that is due. So you find a lot more enforcement happening. As an example, you know, there's one report where 20% of the goods arriving at the Canadian border had an improper classification code, and that was an underpayment of about $42 million. To the Canadian government. So the Canadian government and governments globally are paying attention to that.
Yeah, so I want to dig a little bit into the timing of all this right now. You've been doing this for a long, long time, but it appears to me, and maybe I'm just getting into this game and didn't notice it before, but it appears to me that over the last couple of years in particular, cross-border commerce has been heating up significantly. Like a step function difference compared to what it was 5 years ago. I mean, we were interviewing Carlos Cashman, the CEO, founder of Thrasio, And in the interview, Carlos told us that one of their key competencies is scaling and creating process around bringing typically US-based small product companies into Europe and abroad more generally. It's just a growth area for them. And we're just hearing this over and over again. And so this is all predating COVID. So what is it about like this moment in time that makes cross-border such a hot topic for companies?
Well, I think there's a few things at play. One is, there's a lot of, we started doing this 20 years ago, trying to help companies go global. So there's been obviously a lot of other companies and services that have followed suit, including supply chain services and shipping services that have really improved dramatically from back in the day. So, you know, it wasn't where you would take 2 weeks or something to get a shipment. You can get a shipment in, 5 days, it arrives on time, you can track it, you can get over the border, you can calculate duties and taxes. So I think the underlying services to make it possible have come a very long way. And the other element of it is as that's happened and as folks have had a better experience shipping cross border and as they've been exposed to marketplaces like eBay, Amazon, and others where they're getting exposed to global sellers, your mind opens a little bit more to, hey, you know, I don't have to just look at my own market. I know I could have a good customer experience even if I'm buying something from abroad. And then thirdly, I think, you know, there's just been a lot of really interesting products, frankly, that have been developed and marketed. And if you can't get, if there's a new widget that you can only get from the US, well, hey, now I'm not afraid of getting it. I just can't get it because it's in the US. I can get it. I can get it in a reasonable amount of time. It's something that I want, so I'm just going to buy it. So I think it's been that confluence of factors.
Yeah, the first one in particular, I think is one that hit me by surprise almost on how much friction has been reduced logistically over the last 5 years, even in terms of services, support, operations. I remember learning more about the Amazon Dragon Boat program when it first launched and being blown away by it and how they were effectively just purchasing product direct from Chinese factories, putting it on an Amazon owned boat. And they're just, Amazon's taking the whole process in, and that led to a crazy boom of Chinese sellers operating in North American markets and then in other markets. What are other innovations on the logistics front that removed friction and really made it more possible, easier, et cetera, for companies to execute in this way?
Well, I think a lot of it's been around compliance, and certainly, without doing too much flag waving, that's what we concentrate on, because that's really what the challenges are more about. And what Amazon did is, because they brought it in house, they could manage some of those compliance complexities themselves. But so that sort of opened up the possibility. And then there's other capabilities that followed suit back to our earlier discussion. So a Chinese seller can now get goods into the US without using Amazon's Dragon Boat program. They, shipping into other DCs, even if it's Amazon FBA type of program, they can do it themselves. And, we like to think that we've had a part of that in just helping understand, hey, what are your classification codes? What are your restrictions? What are your duty and tax obligations that you need to pay attention to? The Dragon Boat program is just part of creating the wave, it's like our earlier discussion around creating this mindset, this change in awareness of, it is possible. I can ship into the EU for both eBay and Amazon. I can, or my own website, I can ship into the US, I can ship to Australia, I can solve these problems. So, just opening, we're using the example of a Chinese manufacturer, but just open their mind to the possibility that they can do it. And do it at scale.
How much of this is a threat in some way to the market share of the traditional global manufacturing leaders? I mean, I'm thinking of, the Fortune 1000 name brand manufacturers that you can find in any store in America or any of the big markets in Europe or any of the big developed markets in Asia or Latin America. Traditionally, the big manufacturers were the ones that could execute on a global brand and global product distribution strategy, and the small ones couldn't. The small ones were just regionally bound. And these days, you remove the friction, you add the ability to scale compliance and all the legal stuff that you've got to get done to ship abroad. Does this create effectively like mini global manufacturing empires overnight, or like how does this change the competitive landscape in your opinion?
I think it does in some ways, and maybe in others it doesn't. I think there's still a lot of brand recognition out there. There's a lot of value in certain brands. It depends on the area, you know. In fashion and luxury goods, certainly brand is everything and is highly valued globally, and that probably won't change a lot. But where you get, you know, products that are, you know, widgets or electronics goods, or, you know, I'm thinking of like drones or whatever. You're right. There's if you're a global 1000 company, you can, you know, you have awareness, you have the ability to bring out products with awareness of your brand and everything else. But with social media and the distribution capabilities now, you could have someone come up with a new product that could be a world beater and create a brand out of, you know, effectively nothing, which would create, you would expect those to come from the, you know, as you mentioned, the Fortune 1000 companies, but I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case. It could come from anywhere. It could come from somebody's garage. And they could, you know, get some scale of manufacturing in China. They can distribute from China. They can get awareness in social media, and they're often on their way. So, yeah, it's definitely possible.
So, Craig, let's dig into some of the sort of the use cases here. And there's really a couple of scenarios that a brand has to solve for. And there's sort of the, I guess, the B2B version of it, which is, yeah, I want to ship 500 widgets into the US or Germany. And I looked it up actually, and widget goes back to 1931 was the first use of the word.
I use it all the time. So I have to thank whoever came up with that.
Well, I remember it from like my econ 101 class in college. And then it's just lasted. It's kind of amazing.
So we're at the 90th anniversary of the widget.
Yes.
Of
the word widget. Yeah. So that's something that should be celebrated somewhere.
Yeah. There should be a flag and a cake. For sure.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, let's say there's that B2B scenario. You want to ship 500 of these widgets into the US or Germany. And then there's the B2C, like I want to ship consumer goods, eaches essentially, to online shippers around the world. Can you kind of talk about the differences and any similarities between those two scenarios and what brands should be thinking about?
Yeah, sure. There's one major similarity. And as you mentioned, there are some differences. So let's start with B2B. B2B is really all about compliance. So, you know, with B2B shipments, governments are not surprisingly a lot more interested in making sure that everything is accurate because of the volume and the value of the goods coming in. So you have to make sure you have the correct classification code for the country you're going into, commonly known as an HS code. It's the code that a country wants to assign to any level of product. So any product that ever crosses a border has what are commonly called HS codes, bit of a misnomer, but they're called HS codes, which just tells the country what that thing is from their perspective. And each country, you know, they're common up to six digits. It's like a six digit nomenclature is common for almost every country in the world. But the interesting thing is almost all countries append between three and six digits, commonly four, for a 10-digit code. So you have to have the correct code. Also on B2B, you need to know, you know, there's other things that you need to be aware of. There's anti-dumping, there's PGA, OGA restrictions, which means, you know, other government agencies such as FDA or, you know, Health Canada or something like that, where if your products fall into those categories, you have to be aware of it. You have to be aware of any types of restrictions. And then thirdly, you know, you should be able to take advantage of any tariffs, any preferential tariffs that are in place between those countries. So the USMCA is an example. There's many others. So from a B2B standpoint, it's very much about compliance, about making sure that your goods aren't getting stopped at the border, that you're not getting assessed penalties because you're declaring correctly. So that's, you know, from a B2B standpoint. And that's also applies to B2C. So those compliance questions of, hey, what is this thing you're shipping into the country? Well, on B2C, you don't have to be quite as worried about anti-dumping and some of the other types of restrictions. From a B2C standpoint, you still have to declare what the good is coming in the country. You have to declare it accurately. And you also have to know, you know, whether or not it's restricted. There are certain things that can't be imported in certain countries. Leather goods into Italy is a famous one, chewing gum to Singapore, camouflage clothing to Saudi Arabia. So those are all good examples where, you know, so you've got this common compliance thread that you have to be able to solve. The difference is really in a B2C situation, you have a buyer on the other end of the transaction, obviously, and they want to know how much it's going to cost them, not surprisingly. So, you know, going back the Wayback Machine again, 20 years ago, we were just happy to get something, you know, let alone know how much it's going to cost us. So that's really what's important from a B2C standpoint, is you have to make sure your customer has a good experience. They expect a good experience, even if it's cross-border. And that means you need to tell them how much it's going to cost them. So you need to calculate the duties and import taxes, let them know what those are going to be. And, you know, you go back to the HS codes we talked about. Well, the HS codes are kind of the Rosetta Stone that allows you to calculate duties and taxes accurately. So if you have the correct HS codes, now you can figure out exactly how much your duties are going to be and your import taxes if they apply. And you can do that in a couple of different ways. You know, it doesn't mean you have to collect it at checkout. That's sort of best practice, but you can also just say, hey, you may have to pay this amount when the good is delivered. So you set an expectation. And if you don't do that, which we see, I know in my career, I've seen happen a lot, you just run into all kinds of problems because you ship to a customer, they get charged. I mean, somebody somewhere is going to pay the duties and taxes. So if the customer gets charged at the door, obviously they're not going to be very happy. So that's a bad customer experience. They may refuse to take the good, which means that, you know, you've got a good stuck in country that you now have to get back at your cost. And the carrier is still going to be expecting you to pay the duties and taxes. So it's a good experience for no one. So you really have to know, you know, those common compliance threads of, you know, really HS codes are the key to the whole thing. The de minimis threshold. So at what point do you have to charge duty and tax? And, you know, what can you and what can't you ship?
I imagine that that's part of the reason why a tech platform had to come along. Like, if you're going to do this at scale, and, you know, it reminds me sort of what, you know, trying to track the retailer requirements, it's of product content attributes. I'm imagining keeping up with all of the things that you're describing, that Singapore doesn't want gum.
Yeah.
You know, they love a clean street there. and it just, I imagine that that's part of the complexity, but I'm going to just ask sort of, how do, you know, a lot of firms, I imagine, you know, we're halfway through the year, they're starting to think about 2022, they're looking for where additional revenue opportunities can come from and where they can connect with more consumers. What do you see best practices of firms doing to approach this kind of complexity at scale? What are the elements of that strategy that's required?
Yeah, we like to think of it as, you know, people, process, and technology. So we have, from our perspective, you can use automation. So for us, for example, there's been huge advances, again, kind of referencing my history, but huge advances in the technology available to do things automatically at scale. So we're certainly big proponents of that. We invest a lot in technology and artificial intelligence. So, you know, figuring out, let's go back to the HS codes, figuring out an HS code. Well, from an incoming payload of an item description, you know, value, where it's going, we can figure out a lot automatically. And that, you know, allows us to create economies of scale and do things at a very efficient level from a cost standpoint. But still, you know, you have to have the ability, even with an HS code, if there's not enough information in the payload, for example, hey, do you have a fallback of people who can use automation and AI assisted technology to come up with the right answer in a very time sensitive and cost effective way? And that's how we think about it. So it's this combination of people and technology that creates a really interesting approach to dealing with the complexity and doing it at scale that we don't think is very prevalent in the market, but I think that it's something that can be used to great effect.
Is there a standard kind of customer profile of someone that comes to you and what state they're usually in terms of how what they're confronting? Do a lot of people already have their B2B kind of figured out, but it's getting more complex? Plus, we'd like to try this D2C stuff, or what are you seeing? And is there a pattern that's worth talking about?
Yeah, it's really, I can't say there's a pattern. I would say there are patterns depending on the segment or the type of customer. So you'll see with, you mentioned B2B. So you'd be shocked at still how manual and how poor the information is coming from B2B transactions, where, a customs broker may get a description from a manufacturer of T-shirt on the customs invoice. Well, hey, what is it made of? There's a lot of other things that could go into it. So what they would typically do is just, okay, if it's a T-shirt, here's what the maximum duty is for any type of T-shirt. So we're just going to charge that. And, from a P&L standpoint, that's not great. So it's really creating good information right at the outset. And then, when you think about back to the compliance thing that we were talking about, and from a B2C standpoint, you see sort of the mid-size, smaller retailers are just, help us deal with all of the complexity, help us, sort it out. It's just, I need you to just help me figure it out. I just need some tools to figure this out.
Fix it.
yeah, exactly. And then you see with enterprise companies and platforms, like we're working with Shopify, for example. So, that's really where they're much more sophisticated and they have very clear idea of what they want to do. We have a large customer in the UK, for example, who wanted to take control of the supply chain. They were using kind of a black box provider and said, hey, we need you to do that. We want you to do the HS codes, the duty and tax calculation. We want you to solve the compliance piece, but we want to control the customer experience. We want to be the ones who are dealing with the carriers, and because that really is the customer experience. Similarly with the platforms, they want to make their platform a place where selling is easy and not just domestically, but globally. And that means putting the tools natively inside the platform so that their sellers have an easy go of it. And I think, Shopify and others have been leading the way in making it simple to do not just domestic transactions, but cross-border transactions. But it all goes back to, somebody somewhere has to solve the compliance puzzle. And that's really the challenge.
Yeah. And it's a challenge that I think can go pretty deep. My dad's Cuban. And so we know a lot of Cubans, and getting Cuban cigars in the United States is illegal and challenging. And I have known folks that would order cigars from, I would say, creative sellers internationally, where they would package the cigars in rugby shirts, and they'd put rugby shirts on the label on the package to import them, and yeah, it'd be rugby shirts, but in the middle a ton of Cuban cigars. So
you just have to come to Canada, Rob. There you go.
Yeah. I know the Canadians and all your freedoms up there.
There's so many reasons to go to Canada.
Well, not right now. We're still in lockdown.
True. Well, come on in with the vaccines. The water's fine.
There you go. Exactly.
So to close out, Craig, I'd love to just kind of ask, I was talking earlier about, hey, we're halfway through. People are planning for 2022. What do you think, what's coming up? What sort of, how should we be thinking about what's coming up in cross-border commerce?
Well, you know, I think it's just more of the same of the themes that we were talking about at the outset. You know, we like to think about it as the good, bad, and the ugly. You know, the good is that e-commerce has boomed. It's doesn't show any signs of slowing down. Cross-border demand is increasing, so there's a huge opportunity out there for the folks that can. That can figure it out. The bad and the ugly are more about the figuring it out part. So, you know, the bad, or maybe it's not bad, but it's, you know, something you have to consider is that consumers want a good experience. So they want that cost transparency. They want delivery in a reasonable time frame. So that puts more pressure on the seller to provide a good experience, calculate the duties and taxes, create a clear shipping path, visible tracking, et cetera. And then, you know, really the ugly is around having to deal with all the regulatory change. So we mentioned the EU in July, but I think that that's only going to accelerate. You know, there's a lot of eyes on what's happening in the EU. There's going to be a lot more interest from governments. I mean, you just think about how much money governments globally have spent on COVID from a social safety net standpoint. And, you know, the money is going to have to come from somewhere. So this is going to be, unfortunately, one of the areas that it comes from. We're all going to have to pay. So it's important to make sure that you understand what those regulatory changes are, that you keep pace with them, and that you're collecting the right amount of money and remitting the right amount of money to the governments, or else they're going to come looking for you.
Well, I can't think of a more positive way to end than we're all going to have to pay.
Yeah. Death and taxes, right?
Death and taxes. Death and taxes, that's right. Well, Greg, I'm glad you're just in the taxes business, not in the death. Yeah. Business. That's much more fun.
Well, expansion. There's always future expansion.
Peter. True. Yeah,
there's always new opportunities out there.
Think of what you could fit in the coffins.
Yeah. Cuban cigars.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Craig, we really appreciate you coming on and talking about this topic. I know that thinking about how to expand business and build new revenue streams and connect with more consumers is on a lot of people's agenda. And we're appreciative that you come and talk about kind of the nuts and bolts and what's possible. Really appreciate it.
Sure. I'm happy to do it. And, you know, just my marketing folks will get angry with me if I don't quickly say that, if, you know, there's a lot of information out there for our part. Avalara.com/goglobal is where we store our information if you're interested.
Great. Great tip. And thanks again.
All right. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thanks again to Craig for sharing his expertise and for making me wonder about the origin of the word widget. Please share this episode with your tax nerd colleagues and share a review wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for being part of our community.